Welcome to Purifying Truths with Ace Star. So glad to have you tuned in with us today. Today we have with us a phenomenal speaker. Oh my goodness, he has stepped in seemingly every path of life that there is. So many gems for us to learn from, Kellen Flueckinger. And I'm sorry if I messed up your name, but welcome to Purifying Truths. Please correct me.
Thank you. And you did, it was very close, Flueckinger. First thing I want to do is honor you for your effort to do this. You know, we breathe and add carbon dioxide just by being alive, but you've made a choice to do good and add good to the world and to be a force for good. And I applaud that. And I want to honor you for the work and love that you're bringing to this effort.
Oh my goodness. Thank you so very much. It is so appreciated. So let's talk about you. Wow. I'm so honored to have you on as a guest today. We'll jump right in talking about your childhood. I guess that's where things started to partake. And how was your childhood growing up, please?
Well, everything starts when we're little. And, my mom got married really young, and she was very inexperienced, but she was very committed, religious, and, you know, be a good boy. Only to her, it was, there's only one way to do this. And the only way she knew how to get us, me particularly, but to get us to behave was through physical discipline. And the discipline that we got then today would be felony child abuse, and we would be removed from the home. I remember, you know, hiding in my room. I remember learning to be a pathological liar so I could protect myself. I remember getting dressed in high school, last in the locker room, to hide because I didn't want my friends to see I was black and blue, from beatings. Uh-huh. And so I've long since forgiven any issue with that. But what's important is what that did to me was it left me with a underlying fundamental truth. And that truth was, I am not good enough. I suck. I'm not okay, and I never will be. And that's kind of the framework that I went into my life with. And the sad flip side of that is I need to do everything I can to prove that I'm okay to my mom. Uh-huh. And you would think that when you leave home, I left home at 17, and you'd think that when you leave, you'd sort of break free of that. But somehow I believed that she, maybe it was the religious thing, I don't know, but I believed that she was right, and so I had to prove it to her. The problem with that is I didn't know how to love. I didn't know how to be loved because everything that I had experienced was conditional. And so I went about doing what I knew how to do, which was make money. But I was a failure at almost every other aspect in life. I was married and divorced 3 times. I had a lot of kids, and I probably was a horrific dad. I did not do the same things to them that was done to me. I vowed that I wouldn't do that. But I was miserable inside. I remember saying, like, I don't know how to feel. I can be anybody you like a method actor, being an alias or a legend or something. I can be whoever you need me to be, and I can do a really good job. But when the lights go out and I'm alone, I have no idea who I am.
Wow. That must be devastating, especially from a child, you know, just not knowing how to feel. I can only imagine what you went through, and that it even continued even to high school and even followed you after you moved out of your parents' home. So as you're going through life and you are dealing with learning who you are and how to feel, I believe that you took a bow into some depression. Is that true?
Well, I remember starting experimenting with drugs to escape when I was 13. That pattern went on and off through my whole adult life. And when I say whole adult life, I'm talking about a 40-year period from 13 to 53. So from 13 to 53, I repeated a cycle of creating big success financially and career-wise, sabotaging it, sometimes with drugs, sometimes with failed relationships. But the feeling was, I don't deserve this. And so I would engage in some kind of sabotaging behavior, either with personally, with my health, with drugs, or with the relationship, and kept ruining things over and over again for 40 years. And the only thing I was really good at was making money. So my successes got bigger and bigger. There was a time when I made so much money that my $3,000 a week cocaine addiction was lunch money.
Wow.
It didn't matter. I was doing that. I had bodyguards. I had high profile work. But behind the scenes, I was a complete disaster.
Hmm. You know, many times we look at those that we assume are leaders or that we assume have it all put together. And sometimes we envy or covet what they have. But truly, you're an example of what you see is not the whole picture. It's just the facet that they're showing us. Because behind closed doors where nobody could see, you were falling apart. And you did this year after year after year. You said a few times that, you know, you were good at making money. And I know so many people think that if I had, you know, fill in the dollar amount, that life would be so much better. But truly, it takes more than money because you had that and you still had problems. You still had depression. You still didn't know how to feel. So please tell us, as you're going through this, you had multiple marriages, you had children, but did you go to rehab? How did you seek help? Did anybody notice what you were doing and maybe have an intervention?
No, I hit it. I would learn to lie. I did go to rehab. I went to rehab several times, but I lied and I smuggled drugs in. I had drug dealers mail me stuff in secret packages. Wow. I snuck off campus and bought alcohol. I believed that I could do whatever I needed and wanted to do. And I lived in that sort of arrogant stupidity, thinking that this must just be how it is. I'm that. So let's just, you know, rock on. And I hated myself for it. I tried suicide twice. My behavior was reckless. I just engaged in reckless, stupid behavior. And the only reason I'm not dead and my suicide attempts, for example, were failed is because God had other ideas. Like he wasn't going to let me end it that way. That just wasn't going to happen. I didn't know that at the time. I couldn't figure out why I wasn't dead. I couldn't figure out why I never got caught in the sense of someone caught me, I got fired, embarrassed, arrested. Like none of that happened. And I didn't understand why. I smuggled drugs through airports. I did all kinds of insane things that should have landed me in jail or dead or both. And it didn't happen.
Well, you know, there is a such thing as divine intervention. I truly believe that sometimes even when we have given up and we don't know what to do, there's someone behind the scenes pulling the strings and keeping us here for a reason. And I believe truly that your life has been changed and turned around and you're here for a reason. So let's talk about that. You're now a coach, you're an author, you're so much more, and you no longer are dealing with addiction, correct?
Right. Oh, absolutely.
Wonderful. And you have taking care of the depression. Are you having been treated for that or have you been treated?
I am. And I'll tell you the story. In 2007, it wasn't like a gradual thing. August of 2007, I was at the height of my power. I was making so much money that those drugs didn't matter. I was divorced for the third time, single again for the third time. I had four teenage children living with me. I had 10 kids. Four of them were teenagers living with me. Some of them were grown up and married. But it was August of 2007. I came home on a Friday night, fully intending to go out and binge party for the weekend. And for some reason, I felt impressed to turn on the television. Now, that doesn't sound like anything, except I didn't watch TV, and I didn't know how to turn it on. I had the biggest I had the biggest gear you could get. I'd had some electronic store come and install the giant flats, blah, 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 all over the place. But then I wanted to turn it on and realized I didn't know how. So I had to ask one of my kids, 16-year-old daughter, turned it on, and then she threw the remote at me and stomped out of the room. It landed on a show I'd never heard of, but that's not a surprise since I didn't know any of them. The name of the show was Intervention. which, if you know that, it's a reality TV show about interventions, right?
Yes, yes.
I never even heard of it. Now get this. It gets better. The protagonist was a high-ranking executive with a cocaine problem.
Oh.
So I'm watching this for about 10 minutes, and I turned it off, and I said, I'm not watching this crap. So I stomped around the house for 10 or 15 more minutes and just literally ready to walk out the door, and I felt compelled to turn the TV back on. So I did. This time I knew how. So I turned the TV back on, and that program started over at the beginning in the middle of the hour. And no, I don't have a DVR, and no, it wasn't on the schedule, and no, it can't do that. But it did. So it scared the crap out of me. So I sat down and I decided I better watch the show. So I watched it. It went really badly. The guy refused all the help, got mad at his relatives, screamed at everybody, and that's how it ended. But it scared me bad enough that I didn't go out. I went to bed. When I went to bed, I went to hell. Now, what I mean by that is I had an experience that I can't describe, but what it consisted of was the entire parade, not in an accusatory way, but the entire parade of the things that had happened in my life sort of played out on a stage before my eyes. Mm-hmm. And all the sadness and heartache of mine and everyone else's that I'd caused or participated in was sort of played out, kind of like a slow motion train wreck, but it was the most horrific torture I've ever witnessed. I felt so bad. I couldn't breathe. And it went on for interminably. Finally, a voice said, "It is enough." And it was not an angrier voice. It was just a voice. "It is enough." So I woke up, and it was 5 o'clock Saturday afternoon. So about 18 hours had passed.
Wow.
I got out of bed, and I realized that I had been invited to change, that this was an invitation to let it be enough. So I threw away about $1,000 worth of stuff that I had, and I went cold turkey from $3,000 a week to zero in one day. I never touched it again.
Wow.
That was the first part. And that dealt with, I got sober. Boom, done. 2 weeks later was part two. And that was that. So that first part didn't do anything with how I got there, which was untreated depression. Because for 40 years, I'd never spoken to a soul about what was really going on in my life and how empty and blank and ruined I was. So 2 weeks later, because of the position, I hadn't walked away from my job yet. So I was still at work. But because of the position I had, I used to get free things, free box seats to this and tickets to that and favors because people were currying favor all the time. Not bribes, but, you know, pretty expensive gifts, right? And so one of the things I got was two tickets to a Yo-Yo Ma concert. Now, if you know classical music, you know who that is. And if you don't, you don't. That's fine. But he's the pinnacle of performance in classical music. He's a cellist.
Okay.
Anyway, I didn't want to waste the other ticket. So I said to the people that I managed, the groups that I managed, who likes classical music? And some lady in one of the groups said, "I do." And so I looked at her and said, "Have I ever given you anything before?" And she said, "No." I said, "Okay, fine. Here, see you there." So I gave her the ticket. We met at the show, and halfway through, I had this feeling come over me that I recognized from 2 weeks earlier. Now, you got to remember, I'm 2 weeks stone cold sober. So this feeling came over me, and the voice in my head said, "You need to marry this woman."
Oh.
And I said, "You're insane." I failed at that miserably 3 times officially and some other times too, and that's not happening. And so later that night, we were backstage because they were backstage passes, of course. And the voice came back and said, "Comma, and you need to tell her tonight."
Oh, my.
And so I argued furiously because, you know, she could have sued me for sexual harassment or whatever, right? She was working in one of my groups and I didn't know her very well. And I'm like, holy crap. But you don't win those arguments. So I did. And it went about like you would have expected. You're out of your mind. What are you talking about, etc. But within 2 weeks, she had her own set of experiences. I quit, walked away from millions of dollars of contracts. She resigned. And we wandered off into the sunset together. And that was 14 years ago. That angel was sent to help me with part two, which was the depression. She's the only sane person I've ever known. She has been unflagging in finding people to talk to, resources, and so forth. And the first few years were rough. I mean, I lied to every shrink I talked to. I didn't even know how to tell the truth because I was trying to be in control of everything. But we went through all of that. And after about 4 years of work, everything changed in terms of starting to manage depression, understand what it was, learning to have a friend, learning how to love, learning how to be loved, learning to understand what it was like to feel and to understand my own feelings and so forth. So for the last 10 years, after 4 years of work, I've written 15 books. I do nothing except help people who are struggling, not necessarily with depression or drugs, but those that are ending addiction to mediocrity, who are trying to understand what that yearning is we all feel to do better and be better. And so that was the divine intervention. And the only reason I'm nobody special. I imagine it was so noisy because I was so thick-headed.
Well, I'm so glad that you had the intervention and that you met this angel. Tell me, please, Keelan, when you stopped, did you have any withdrawal symptoms, any cravings, anything like that? Because from what I hear, that's what gets people on the cycle of going back into addiction.
Well, there were all kinds of cravings, but no amount of craving could equal the feeling of what had happened. I mean, the power of that, what had happened to me, both that 18 hours, some out-of-body experience, I mean, that was visceral and real. Like today, I can remember that 14 years ago like it was last night. There is no question about what happened, what was going on, that it was an invitation. The feeling about every time I talk about what happened with my wife, oh, by the way, and her name is Joy. Like, you can't make this stuff up, right?
That's beautiful.
I know. You can't make this up. So those things are clear and present for me every single day. And so, yeah, there was all kinds of cravings and excuses and desire and trips into depression. I mean, I have 10 kids and half of them still, even to this day, don't talk to me because of all the divorces and drugs and stuff like that. And so I have opportunity and work. But that used to drag me into hell, that feeling of it's my fault. Now I'm just feeling love and patience because there will be a time they will walk the road. I'm full of love and open arms, and the day will come, no matter what, when that will have an opportunity.
I agree. I agree that it will happen as long as you keep doing what you're doing. You are helping so many with your work. Notice that you mentioned that you've authored multiple books, but I want to just zone in a little bit about your near-death experience. Would you share that with us, please?
Yeah. You know, that I don't know why. I mean, I know why the first divine intervention happened. It was a wake-up call with those two parts to get me organized. 3.5 years ago, in the summer of 2018, Joy and I went on a cruise, and neither one of us had ever been on a cruise before. I don't know why, we just hadn't. So we went on a cruise in the Baltic Sea. At the end of it, I got sick, and we were in Oslo, Norway, and I got sick, and really sick. That was Monday. Tuesday, we flew home from Amsterdam. We live in Edmonton, Alberta, so in the frozen north. So we flew home and got home Tuesday night, and I was sick, and I did stupid. I didn't go to the doctor. I figured, well, it's a really, really bad flu, so it'll be okay. Wednesday, Thursday, I stayed home, stayed in bed. Friday, it was horrific, and I decided I need to go. So I went to the walk-in clinic, which is what they have here in Canada, and they wouldn't let me in. They took one look at me and said, you can't come in here, and besides, we can't do anything for you. Go directly to the University of Alberta Medical Center. Get out of here. And so I did, and I went to the ER there, and, you know, and you go to the emergency, it might be an hour or two or three, depending on how busy they are and what's going on. In 10 minutes, I was in a private room. I didn't even know they had private rooms in the ER. Like, they always have those curtains and things, right?
Right.
I'm like, I don't even know what's happening. So they started, I must have looked horrific. So they did all these tests on me, and they said immediately, well, we're going to admit you in the hospital. We don't know what the heck's going on, but this is not okay. Then they came back in a couple hours and said, yeah, we're going to put you in intensive care. Then they came back in a couple hours and said, yeah, except we're also going to put you in biological isolation, which is alone in a double door airlock room because I'm the fungus from Mars, right? So I'm in bio isolation and in ICU. And then they said, and I had sent Joy home because there was nothing she could do. And we had dogs and cats and stuff to go take care of. So she went home. I said, come back in the morning and we'll figure out what's going on. Then they came in and said to me, hi, do we have permission to intubate you and do anything we need to do to preserve your life? And of course, that question scared the crap out of me. So I went into meditation. Meditation is something I've practiced for decades. And I could feel my body and spirit separating, which was this weird feeling, and I knew I was dying. And so I sent Joy a text. She was asleep by then and didn't see it, but it don't, and I was trembling so badly I could barely use the phone, but it had three lines in it. The first line said, ICU. The second line said, isolation / intubation. And the third line said, I may be dying. She didn't see that. She was asleep. Oh. About 2:30 or 3 in the morning, she got a call from the hospital that said, are you coming? And she said, what? And then she saw my text. Sometime at that, somewhere in there, my heart stopped and I died. And so I came to spiritually, energetically in a gray room. I was horizontal, which is like I was on the stretcher, but my spirit or whatever that energy came to, and I could see around the room. It was a gray room, kind of soft gray, like photo card gray. Mm-hmm. Except over my left shoulder, I could see a doorway. And I wanted to be at the door. And so suddenly I was at the door, and I was leaning on the door jamb on my right shoulder. And right across the door on the other side was someone leaning on the door jamb on that shoulder, just kind of casually standing there. And I noticed that my side of the room, was the door was gray, and the other side of the doorway was white. That wasn't streaming through or anything. It was just white on that side, gray on my side. Uh-huh. And then he looked at me and he said, do you want to come home? And in a flash, you know where you are, what's going on, what that doorway is, who you're talking to, and everything. And so I'm standing there hyperventilating with this realization. And so we talked about it for a while. And I thought about all the stuff that I was doing and had been doing since what had happened in 2007, eight, which was now 10 years. So this is the 10-year anniversary of that first thing, right? And I'm like, finally, after we talked for a while, I says, well, I'm not done. And he said, okay. And I'm quite certain that it was at that point they were able to restart my heart. But anyway, that was just the beginning, because the next day, and I don't know how it was the next day. You just know that stuff. So the next day, I'm back at the doorway, and I'm standing there, same thing, same place. And the topic of the previous day wasn't brought up. That was decided. So and then he asked me, okay, so what are you going to do? And so we talked about my coaching and the work I was doing and the books I'd already written and what I was trying to do. And then it was like, for any of your listeners that have seen that Jodie Foster movie, Contact, where they have build an alien spaceship and do something. If you haven't seen it, that's fine. But it was, it depicts a really intense experience where she is overwhelmed by the intensity of the communication and the information. And I felt like that. If I hadn't been sort of in a protective bubble, I would have been incinerated. But anyway, that went on for a while. And I felt just incredible download of sights and wisdom and all this other stuff. But I came away with four really important things which matter to the me, you, everybody, and that is these. Number one is every single one of us. Make no mistake, we're a divine creation that was intentionally built, created, and there's no accident about any of it. Number two, each one of us, intentionally and purposely, were given gifts and talents that were to be part of this existence here. Number three, we each have mission and purpose that we not only agreed to, but we were stoked about before we came here. And number four, all the help we need is available from both sides of that door.
From both sides.
So after that happened, I said, well, okay, since that's true, why do we settle for crumbs? Like, what is it that makes us generally settle for crumbs compared to what we could have? And I don't know if in the economy of heaven, brevity is a virtue, but the answer is four words. Because you don't believe. And it was like, hyperventilating again, like, duh, okay, we don't believe it's possible. We don't believe in ourselves. We don't believe in our capabilities. We don't believe that change is possible. We don't believe all these things that this could mean. And so I said, well, what can I do to help that? What can I do about that to make that better? And he said, oh, glad you asked. So then there was another, I'm serious, glad you asked. So then there was this another whole framework of things about how to change beliefs, about how to work with and change beliefs. And I wrote that. I wrote a book called Meeting God at the Door, which is the entire experience. I wrote a second book, which was the content of this conversation, called The Book of Context, because context is that set of beliefs that we have about how we think, what we can have, how the world works, what's available, what's not available, what's possible, what's not possible. And we live in a context straitjacket. It keeps us from doing all the stuff that we could do, but we don't have to, right? And so that's so that was the end of the second conversation. And the third conversation, the next day, back at the door, and this time I'm buzzing. I'm so excited in my head. I'm repeating all the stuff and going over the framework of the book of context and just buzzing. We're back at the door, and I'm there, and he looks at me and he says, are you sure? And I started hyperventilating again. Like, what do you mean? Am I sure? Am I stupid? Did I miss something? Am I in over my head? Like, what? Am I sure? And so we talked about it for quite some time. And finally I said, I'm sure. He said, okay. And nothing was said, but the conversation ended with the finality that I knew we were done. And then about 2 weeks later, I came out of the coma. I was in a coma for about two and a half weeks, about 17 days. And so that was that experience. And that is the reason that it is an absolute truth that I don't do anything except work on those principles, which is how can I help people understand who they really are?
What an experience. I mean, most of us think that this is, you know, sci-fi and made up, but you have actually experienced it and you're here to tell the story. You know, I'm so glad that you're sharing and that you are pouring into others. It's amazing, just amazing how you were inspired and that you continue to do the work.
Well, it's funny. So I got out of the hospital mid-July, and I had lost 35 pounds. I was so weak I couldn't walk. It completely physically destroyed me. What I ended up having was an illness. It was very difficult to get. It was a necrotizing MRSA, necrotizing superbug, antibiotic-resistant superbug. The doctor told me, he said, the 10-day mortality rate of what you had is 100%.
Wow.
And I said, okay.
And yet you beat those odds.
Well, I didn't do anything. It was a conversation and a choice. So anything is possible.
Yes.
But I should have. I mean, no wonder I died. It's like, duh, you should have died. Like you had a lethal illness with 100% mortality rate. And they kept asking me, where did you go? How did you even get this? Like, it's really difficult to get. Mm-hmm. It completely trashed my lungs. They told me my lungs might take 2 years to never to get back to anything even close to normal. So I still have a lot of wheeze sometimes when I talk, and it has worked. I've had to work really hard to get my singing voice back because I do a lot of music stuff. But anyway, after I learned to walk again and everything else by October, which was 3 or 4 months later, let's see, July, August, September, October, 3 months, I went to 4 different places that I had scheduled to go speak. I went on a little speaking tour. And at one of the places, it was time for questions afterwards, and somebody said, a lady that I knew her vaguely, but in the audience, it was a mastermind that I belonged to, and she said, so what's the biggest thing that's happened to you, because this, like, what's the biggest change? And I hadn't really prepared for questions, so I started thinking about it, and while I was thinking, I heard my mouth open and say, I no longer experience fear. And I thought about that, and someone asked me about that later, and that spawned another book called Walking Without Fear. But someone asked me later, so what does that even mean? How can you not be afraid of anything? And I got real quiet for a minute, And then I got emotional as I thought about it. And then I said, given what's happened, I said, what is there in the world? What on earth do I have to be afraid of?
That's pretty deep. You've been through a lot. And certainly, what is it? What is it? There is nothing.
I mean, there's nothing. There's nothing. And so here's the important thing. Big deal for me. What matters is you and each one of your listeners are just as important. Your mm-hmm. mission, your purpose, your value is just the same. And that's why it's so important for us to do what you're doing with creating this podcast, or for anybody to give in to those yearnings that say, do good, be more, reach, serve, love, bless, forgive. That's where power and truth and happiness live.
I totally agree. I know that even though we may not all have your experience, that we all have a calling, an innate feeling, a consciousness. We know what we are to be doing. And sometimes we suppress that still small voice, as they call it. But certainly we need to be more in tune and listen to it so that we can empower others, such as you're doing. It has been a pleasure having you on Purifying Truths. You have dropped some phenomenal gems. Oh my goodness, we haven't had time to open up nearly half of what you have done and all the things that you do. But for the audience that wants to connect with you, please tell us, how can they reach you?
You know, one of the fun things about having a weird name like Kellen Flukiger is that I'm super easy to find. Like, there are 2 out of 8 billion, and the other one is my son. So aww. If you can Google me, you just spell my name right. That's what, but if you Google me, I'm easy to find. There's thousands of hits. I'm on Amazon with books and music. I'm on Spotify. I also have a podcast that I'm doing called Your Ultimate Life. It's on all the platforms, Facebook, LinkedIn, anywhere. I'm super easy to find, easy to connect with, and thrilled to do whatever I can to help you live your ultimate life.
Amazing, amazing. And just to be clear, we're going to spell out your name so that no one messes it up.
All right. My name's Kellen, K-E-L-L-A-N. Mm-hmm. Last name is weird. F like Frank, L-U-C-K-I-G-E-R. Pronounced Flukiger, and it's Swiss, in case anybody wonders.
All right. We will definitely be in touch with you on social media, and hopefully, you know what I mean, get some of your books. Certainly, they are good reads. I know they must be just from the time that we've talked. I mean, I know there's a few that I want to glean from. If you had one word, one message, I guess I should ask, that you would like to leave with the audience, what would that be?
That's easy. And it is this. It doesn't matter where you are now. It doesn't matter what has happened to you, who has done what hardship on you, or what struggles you have faced or are facing. It is never too late to matter, to change, to get help, support, and to live with joy, manifesting your divine gifts. It is never too late or too hard, and it is worth anything you have to do to be there.
Wow. Thank you so much for pouring in to us today on Purifying Truths. You are phenomenal.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for the good work you are doing in the world.
Absolutely. And thank you for tuning in to Purifying Truths with A-Star. Tune in every Saturday at 9 and noon for exciting new guests who illuminate the world in the various facets of life. You too can connect with A-Star. Facebook and Instagram at Facets of a Star. Please visit the website www.facetsofastar.com. Shine bright.